From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Boston.
And I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. Another day of impassioned debate is taking place at the Indiana Statehouse. Lawmakers there are considering a near total ban on abortion. If passed, Indiana's law would be one of the strictest in the nation. Thousands of people on both sides of the abortion issue made their voices heard yesterday as a special legislative session got underway. WBEZ reporter Michael Puente is there. And Mike, how much attention is being paid in Indiana to this special session?
Oh, a lot of attention is paid to it. This is a special session has rarely occurred in Indiana. In fact, it just started this year as a way to address budgetary concerns. But when Roe versus Wade was overturned by the Supreme Court, the Indiana General Assembly decided to use it as an opportunity to pass more restrictions on abortion.
Indiana is one of the first Republican-controlled state legislators that would consider this near-total ban on abortions since the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. What are the specifics of this proposal?
Well, right now, they are still, arguing over what the specifics would be. But right now, there would be very few exceptions to abortion. They would be pregnancy in cases of rape, incest, if the mother's life is at risk, or what's called fatal-fetal anomalies. So those exceptions right there would be the only exceptions right now under the proposed bill, which a female can seek an abortion.
I understand this is a bill, it's a proposal. We don't know what, if anything, will be passed into law. But under this proposal, I understand women wouldn't be committing a criminal offense if they tried to get an abortion. What about doctors?
Well, that's really one of the main concerns. Doctors are feeling pressure that they could be subject to not criminal prosecution, but the loss of their license. In fact, they were debating the committee hearing this bill that the female seeking an abortion, if she was to get one, would not be subject to a criminal investigation. But the doctor certainly would have to go through before a sort of a review board to see if they committed any violation of the law. And if they did, they could lose their license.
So even though this would be one of the strictest anti-abortion laws in the country, if it were passed, some members of the public think it doesn't go far enough. Here is a minister named Brian Schrenk.
I've seen firsthand how Indiana has become an abortion tourism state, with many men and women coming from Ohio and Kentucky to murder their children since Roe was overturned. I'm calling on you, to senators, to fear God more than you fear the left and to abolish this evil once and for all.
Michael, what are the views of the citizens of Indiana? I know that broadly in the United States, there's a lot of support, majority support for abortion rights. What about in Indiana?
Well, Indiana is a very conservative Republican state. And the first day of the session yesterday, there were definitely supporters or opponents on both sides of the line. There are many abortion access advocates were out in force yesterday, but also you had a number of conservatives who took Republican members of the Indiana legislature to task, saying that the bill that's being proposed, which has the exceptions, was not strong enough. And they were urging a total ban on abortion with no exceptions.
We only have about 30 seconds here, Michael, but do Republicans have the chance to get this through?
I believe so, but it is going to have those exceptions in there, and that I believe the more conservative the Hoosiers are not going to be happy with it. And this is not going to stop the abortion debate in Indiana, because they are going to continue to push for a total ban.
Michael Puente covers Indiana for WBEZ. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Tensions are growing between the U.S. and China. The issue is a reported trip to Taiwan planned by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Last week, China warned of strong and resolute measures if the visit goes forward, and that concerns the Biden administration. Now, Pelosi would not confirm or deny the trip at a press conference last week, but she did say this.
I think that it's important for us to show support for Taiwan. I also think that we have, none of us has ever said we're for independence when it comes to Taiwan. That's up to Taiwan to decide.
Zach Cooper researches U.S. and China at the American Enterprise Institute. He worked at the Pentagon and the White House during the Bush administration. Zach, hello.
Hello. Good to get a chance to talk with you.
So let me ask the basic question. Why would Pelosi, as she reportedly is planning to do, go visit Taiwan in the first place? What's the point?
Well, Nancy Pelosi has a very long history of supporting Taiwan and, in some cases, pushing China on everything from human rights issues to democracy. She famously went to Tiananmen Square and unfurled a poster there, you know, shortly after the protests had been put down. So she, like many other members of Congress, want to show support for Taiwan, especially as it's coming under greater pressure from Beijing.
And yet there are nervous sounds coming out of the White House, another Democrat, Joe Biden, about this visit, fears of a response from China. How might this trip amp up tensions across the Taiwan Strait?
The real risk here is that both sides believe that the other is changing the status quo. And the Chinese think that the United States is moving away from its One China policy, moving away from the longstanding U.S. policy of strategic ambiguity on Taiwan.
And just to understand you, has it been that for decades, the official U.S. position has been purposely kind of fuzzy about whether it would defend Taiwan if it were under attack? And now it seems like the message to Beijing is changing.
That's exactly right. But it's not entirely clear. Because even when the president said a few months ago that the U.S. had a commitment to defend Taiwan, the White House then came back out within a few hours and said that the president wasn't changing U.S. policy, even though he clearly would have been announcing a change in policy.
And how does this look from Taiwan? Surely leaders in Taipei are watching Ukraine, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and seeing the U.S. and other powers largely standing on the sidelines. I mean, how much does Taipei want a Pelosi visit?
That is a great question. I think it probably depends who you talk with. I think there are many in Taiwan who will be excited to see this level of a political visit. And look, that's understandable. You know, for many years, Taiwan has wanted more U.S. support, and now they're getting it. The other side of the coin, of course, is that I'm sure no one in Taiwan wants a major crisis or certainly not a conflict over this visit. I think the concern has to be that, at least from my standpoint, I think we are sort of sleepwalking into a pretty serious crisis here that could absolutely escalate.
And let me ask you about that. Given each country is trying to interpret signals from the other side, this kind of stuff can quickly lead into misunderstandings. What do you see as potential ways this can play out?
I think the Chinese have been trying to signal very clearly that they are going to take some sort of response to a Pelosi visit. They haven't said exactly what that might be, but I think it is very clear that Xi Jinping probably feels that he has to respond fairly forcefully, in part because in just a couple of months, he is likely to be selected as party chairman at the 20th Party Congress. And so I think he will feel that he has to show strength at this moment. Exactly what he does, that's much harder to say. There are some obvious options. One is that they could challenge Pelosi's plane. They could fly fighter aircraft near the plane. And, you know, I think the expectation would be that she would probably be flying in on a U.S. military aircraft. They could declare some type of no-fly zone, at least temporarily, around Taiwan. It reminds me a little bit of what we call the third Taiwan Strait crisis back in 1995-96, when China fired missiles into waters around Taiwan. And that issue, once again, was over a visit, this time by a Taiwanese politician to the United States. But there's some precedent for this.
Do you worry that positions might harden? Pelosi's position, Beijing's position, the White House position?
Absolutely. And we've already seen this with Nancy Pelosi. You know, when her visit was leaked, I think there was a desire from some on her team to keep some space open for her, maybe to delay her visit or just go another time. But once it was leaked, you saw a large number of members of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, coming out in favor of the visit. And then meanwhile, you saw President Biden come out in public and say he didn't think this was a good idea. And, you know, the third factor here is Beijing, and Beijing has been quite clear, and I think it would be hard for them to back down now as well.
You're striking a concerning tone, Zach.
I am. I think this is potentially the worst crisis in U.S.-China relations, at least over Taiwan, in maybe the last 25 or 30 years.
Zach Hooper is a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and he's studying the U.S. relationship with China. Zach, thank you for the time.
Thank you for having me.
The fall of Roe v. Wade is doing more than banning or restricting abortions. It's also having serious impacts on pregnancy care. The abortion bans in some states are so new and often so ill-defined that doctors and hospitals don't know how they apply to complications. NPR's Carrie Feibel brings us the story of a woman in Texas whose pregnancy took a sudden turn. And because of the state's abortion law, her case became a medical crisis.
This story was never supposed to be about abortion. It was supposed to be about pregnancy, a pregnancy that Elizabeth and James Weller had been trying for.
It took immediately, and we were really pleasantly surprised by how quick it happened.
The Wellers live in Houston. She's getting a graduate degree in political science, and he teaches middle school math. At 17 weeks, they found out they were having a girl, and the anatomy scan showed everything looked great.
There was nothing wrong with her, no development issues wrong.
A week after that scan, Elizabeth went for a walk after breakfast. It was May 10th, weeks before the Supreme Court would overturn Roe v. Wade. But in Texas, things had already changed. Most abortions after 6 weeks were banned. Elizabeth didn't think that could affect her. They were going for it. They were setting up the nursery. But when Elizabeth got back from her morning walk, she felt something shift inside.
This burst of water just falls out of my body. And I screamed because that's when I knew something wrong was happening.
James rushed home, and they drove to the ER at Houston Methodist Hospital in the Woodlands.
And I asked the technician, I was like, is she okay? And she goes, well, it's kind of hard to tell because there's very little amniotic fluid. At the time, I had no idea what that meant.
It was premature rupture of membranes. Her waters had broken too soon. It happens in about 3% of pregnancies. If it's later in pregnancy, sometimes doctors can delay delivery, give the fetus more time to develop. But sometimes the baby is born far too early and dies, or is born with serious disabilities. Elizabeth was admitted to the hospital. And later that night, her OBGYN called to talk it through. She was 18, almost 19 weeks pregnant. There was still a fetal heartbeat, but it could stop at any moment. The watery cushion of amniotic fluid had disappeared. That also meant the lungs in the fetus would stop developing. Her doctor said one option was to try to stay pregnant, although this could be very risky and would likely not work.
And she says, let's say if you get to the week of viability, which is around 24 weeks, I can't promise you that she will continue to live past that point. And because there's no amniotic fluid left, she's no longer going to be a developed baby.
Elizabeth's doctor wouldn't do an interview for this story. But Dr. Alan Peaceman, a maternal fetal specialist at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, says the chance of a fetus surviving in that state from 18 until 24 weeks is virtually zero.
It's almost inevitable that the pregnancy is going to be lost anyway. And many women would say, why do I have to continue to carry a pregnancy that is doomed? And that's a huge psychological burden.
Prolonging the pregnancy also meant Elizabeth could develop a serious or even life-threatening infection in her uterus. So her other option was to end the pregnancy. Elizabeth was distraught and heartbroken. She could never have imagined making that decision, but now she felt continuing the pregnancy was wrong. It felt scary and also cruel.
You have to ask yourself, would I put any living thing through the pain and the horrors of having to try to fight for their life the minute that they're born?
James was in total agreement. But the next morning, they learned it wasn't their decision to make. The Texas law was making it hard for her OB to arrange the procedure.
I remember hearing her from my room speaking loudly about how nothing is being done here.
Her doctor came back to her bedside. Elizabeth says she looked defeated.
And she starts to cry and she tells me, they're not going to touch you. And that you can either stay here and wait to get sick, where we can monitor you, or we discharge you and you monitor yourself, or you wait till your baby's heartbeat stops.
The Texas abortion law meant they couldn't end the pregnancy as long as there was a fetal heartbeat. There was one exception, for a medical emergency. But wasn't this a medical emergency? Elizabeth was told no. Not yet. She had to wait for more signs of a growing infection in her uterus. Dr. Peaceman in Illinois says the hospital in Houston was dealing with a state law that doesn't define what qualifies as a medical emergency.
It's terrible, but the care providers are treading on eggshells. They don't want to get sucked into this, into a legal morass.
Houston Methodist Hospital declined to comment on the specifics of Elizabeth's care, except to say they follow all state laws and that there's a medical ethics committee that sometimes reviews complex cases.
At first, I was really enraged at the hospital and administration.
To Elizabeth, it already felt like a medical emergency. She had cramps. She was passing blood. But she was told those weren't the right symptoms. She needed a fever of 100.4 and chills. Her discharge had to be darker and it had to smell bad. Then they could proceed and end the pregnancy.
To them, my life was not in danger enough.
Elizabeth says she realized later the hospital was just as trapped as she was.
It wasn't that the Methodist Hospital was refusing to perform a service to me simply because they didn't want to. It was because Texas law put them in a position to where they were intimidated to not perform this procedure.
Under Texas law, doctors can be sued by almost anyone for performing an illegal abortion. Elizabeth was discharged. But she was barely out the door when her phone rang.
But as I'm leaving Methodist, I get a call from Methodist. And it's this woman who is saying, hi, Miss Weller, you're at the 19-week mark. So I'm here to call you to register for your delivery on October 5th so I can collect all your insurance information. How are you doing? And are you excited for the delivery? And I just cried and screamed in the parking lot. This poor woman had no idea what she was telling me. And I told her, no, ma'am, I'm actually headed home right now because I have to await my dead baby's delivery. And she goes, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't know.
Elizabeth went home to wait for one of two things to happen, both awful, for the fetal heartbeat to stop or to get sick enough to become a medical emergency. The next day, Thursday, she started throwing up. But when she called, they said vomiting wasn't one of the symptoms they were looking for. On Friday, she called back and begged to get in. Maybe the fetal heartbeat had finally stopped? They went to the office. The heartbeat was still there. Her OB had been calling other hospitals, but none of them would help. Right there in the office, James started looking for flights to states with less restrictive abortion laws.
And he and I kept telling each other, what is the whole point of the Hippocratic Oath? To do no harm. And yet we're being pulled through this.
They went back home. They started booking tickets. And then suddenly Elizabeth felt another gush of fluid leave her body. The color and odor were much worse. They called the doctor again. Now they were told to go to the ER and hurry. These symptoms showed the infection was getting worse. Elizabeth and James rushed back to Methodist. They were still checking into the ER when her OB called again. The ethics panel had reached a decision.
They found a doctor from East Texas who spoke up and was so patient forward, so patient advocating, that he said, this is ridiculous. Everybody there agreed and decided that what was happening was unethical. And they decided to induce you tonight.
Elizabeth and James stood up and threw their arms around each other. They said thank you out loud, over and over.
We shouldn't have been celebrating. And yet we were, because the alternative was hell.
It was Friday night. They induced labor, and it was so painful that she needed an epidural. After midnight on Saturday, May 14th, she gave birth. Their daughter was stillborn, as expected.
They laid down this beautiful baby girl in my arms. And she was so tiny. And she rested on my chest. I cried and I told her, I'm so sorry I couldn't give you life. I'm so sorry.
6 weeks later, the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. What happened to the Wellers could now happen in many other states, and there are already reports of risky delays for this problem and other pregnancy complications. Elaine Cavazos is a perinatal psychotherapist in Austin. She says there's already so much silence and stigma around pregnancy loss. All too often, patients are told to get over it, move on, try again. Now many patients will also be coping with a new kind of medical trauma.
It's just really unimaginable to be in a position of having to think, how close to death am I before somebody's going to take action and help me?
This frightening lack of control can make the grief over losing a pregnancy much, much worse.
She has had the very worst thing happen to her, and that will color any subsequent pregnancy. It will be hard.
But Elizabeth Weller isn't ready. Watching Roe get overturned enraged her, and she fears not just another complication, but getting trapped by the law again.
This is the one situation in my entire life where I have felt absolutely hopeless and that I was drowning and no one was willing to save me. The state of Texas put me through that mental anguish because I couldn't get the help that I needed.
As abortion rights topple in state after state, a terrible question remains. Even the strictest bans have an exception for the woman's life. But right now, almost no one knows exactly how close to the edge her life needs to be. Carrie Feibel, NPR News.
That is a woman singing O Canada in Cree in Alberta, Canada. That is where Pope Francis apologized yesterday for what he called the evil committed by so many Christians against the indigenous peoples. This apology is more than a century in the making. It refers to the Catholic Church's role in forcing indigenous children into so-called boarding schools. That's where they were banned from speaking their languages or practicing their customs. Thousands were abused and died. Emma Jacobs is covering the story for NPR in Alberta. Hi, Emma.
Thank you for having me.
What struck you yesterday about the scene, about what the Pope said?
The Pope spoke in the ceremonial arbor of a community called Musquechees, and that's not far from the former site of the Ermineskin Indian Residential School, which religious orders ran from 1894 to 1969. His audience was mostly survivors of residential schools and family members of survivors who had in some cases traveled extremely long distances, 8 hours, one group told me 2 days. There was a celebratory feel, but also a lot of emotion.
The Pope also went to a cemetery where former students of a Catholic-run residential school are buried. Tell us a little bit more about that and what we know about who is buried there.
Yeah, there are some students who would have died while they were in the school and some survivors who passed away more recently. And there's a symbolism to this. For the last year, communities have been discovering and announcing that they found unmarked graves on the former sites of residential schools. These discoveries are really what finally pushed the Pope to make this apology. And while this was not one of those sites, it's sort of a stand-in for these burial grounds around the country. Yeah.
Now, this apology from the Vatican comes years after the Canadian government issued its formal apology and its Truth and Reconciliation Committee declared this a cultural genocide. But is there a sense among some Indigenous leaders that the Pope coming and saying for a week that sorry is not enough?
Yeah, reactions are mixed. And you heard this pride and relief that the Pope had come here and apologized where abuses took place. There was this interesting moment where the Pope was speaking in Spanish, and then there would be a pause where a section was translated to English. Mm. And when the apology was reached in English, there was this wave of applause from his audience. But there is more that people would like to see, including the release of records the church is holding on these schools, the return of cultural artifacts that are at the Vatican. And some people I spoke with would really like to see the church commit resources to mental health and substance abuse supports and for language revitalization programs. And some people would like to see the Pope revoke the doctrine of discovery, which comes from these 15th century papal bulls, and sanction the entire colonial project in the Americas.
Emma, what's next? The Pope is in Canada for a week, yeah?
He is participating in a pilgrimage today, and then he delivers a mass in a stadium here in Edmonton. Then he goes on to Quebec City and also to this far northern community called Iqaluit before traveling back to Rome.
That's Emma Jacobs covering the story for NPR about Pope Francis's trip to Canada to apologize to the Indigenous community for its role in the forced removal, attempted assimilation, and rampant abuse and deaths of Indigenous children. Emma, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A new investigation finds some members of the military are returning from deployments to find they've lost their jobs. Service members are a protected class under labor law, which means they're technically shielded from workplace discrimination. Michael DeJuana has been reporting on this for The War Horse, a nonprofit newsroom covering the military, and he joins me now. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
So firing someone when they're deployed is illegal, even if that deployment is extended, right? That's under the Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act of 1994. And yet it is still happening. How common is this?
Yeah, it happens more than you'd think. In 2020, the most recent data available, the Labor Department opened 944 new complaint investigations to add to the 164 cases that it was looking at the prior year, but there are many more that are handled informally by the Defense Department and many others that end up in the hands of private attorneys and even the Justice Department.
That surprised me that it was impossible to get a read on how many of these there are. I wonder, can you give us a specific story of a service member that sort of describes what you're talking about here?
Yeah, sure. You know, I talked to one Navy reservist and hospital corpsman. She had applied for a promotion at her civilian job, and she didn't get it. So she asked her manager, well, what could she have done better? He lowered his voice and he said, you know what? It's not you at all. I think you'd be a great fit. You did great in the interviews, but there's one problem. You're military. And the objection there was that she would be spending weekends away with the Navy to do her training. Long story short, it resulted in a settlement, tens of thousands of dollars. It cost the employer. Their discrimination statement had that they don't discriminate against the military, but somehow the employer had been unaware of the rights that she had.
I mean, obviously, because we don't have a real count, it's hard to know if these things are increasing. But it sounds from your reporting as though this is a bigger problem lately because there have been so many deployments for members of the National Guard. There have been a lot of wildfires, the pandemic.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm told by the Department of Labor that it's exactly times like the pandemic that these cases rise. So after 9/11, they saw a surge in cases. After the pandemic, a surge in cases. Wildfire response surge in cases. And they can be small cases. Some of the cases are settled for a few thousand dollars, but some of them can go into the millions of dollars.
You say that there's a huge range of employers that engage in this behavior in terms of either denying a promotion or even in letting somebody go when they've been deployed, all the way from tiny little family-owned businesses to international corporations. But do we have sort of an idea about a pattern of them, where this is more likely?
You know, it's not. I think that's the lesson here, is that it can happen anywhere. You have massive employers like Walmart and Sam's Club. There was a case that was settled reportedly, for $14 million last year. It involved a guy named Nicholas Sue of New Hampshire. He claimed that a Sam's Club did not provide him with full pay for his Army Reserve absence, yet they had maintained a policy of paying people for jury duty and bereavement leave, but not for military leave. And one of the common themes seems to be that employers don't necessarily know what the rights of these service members are.
So what are the solutions people are talking about? If employers don't know, perhaps there is an educational solution here. Perhaps the education needs to be on the side of the military members who should know that they have legal recourse. How do we solve this?
Yeah, that is one. They have those signs up in the break room in many places that say minimum wage, what your minimum wage might be or what your rights are if you're injured. Print up that poster that says what the rights are for military service members. Also, if you're a manager, the Defense Department has a program, and what it is able to do is basically mediate before a claim gets to the point of being contentious. So listen and make those changes to accommodate the service member in your employment.
Michael DeJoanna is an investigative reporter for The War Horse, a nonprofit newsroom covering the military. Michael, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Warming waters and outdated dams are preventing many fish species from migrating and spawning. So, several fish populations are shrinking across the country. And that includes a species of fish that a Native American tribe in the Mountain West used to rely on. Caleb Radel of the Mountain West News Bureau tells us how that tribe is trying to restore the population.
It's a hot spring day on the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe Reservation in northern Nevada. Clouds hang over miles of remote desert land. Mountain ranges pierce the overcast sky. At the edge of a bluff, tribal member Susan Albright looks down at the Truckee River. Albright works for the tribe's Natural Resources Department and caught fish in those waters as a child.
We used to go out to the mouth of the lake, and they would just throw treble hooks out there and grab a bunch of fish and come back, and that's our lifestyle. That was what everybody ate.
Specifically, Lahontan cutthroat trout, Nevada state fish, and kiwi, which aren't found anywhere else in the world. The Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe refer to themselves as Kiwi Takuta in their native language, which means the kiwi eaters. But they aren't able to eat as much these days. The kiwi have been endangered for decades, and that's partially because of a series of dams on the Truckee River. One is the Numana Dam, which Albright is looking at now as water shoots over the 11-foot-high structure.
Our kiwis can't go back upstream because they're bottom feeders, and that's as far as they can get. You know, since they put dams in there, they really put a damper on everything with our fish.
The Numana Dam was built in 1971 to divert Truckee River water to the reservation to help with agriculture. For the past 20 years, though, the tribe has wanted to modify the dam to help the fish recover. But Donna Noel says they kept running into the same hurdle. She's the tribe's natural resources director.
We always knew we wanted to do it, but, you know, the funding was never available.
That recently changed. This spring, the Interior Department announced 40 projects across the U.S. to support fish recovery and migration. The funding comes from the massive federal infrastructure package. Reeling in the biggest grant? The tribe's Numana Dam Fish Passage Project, which is getting more than $8 million.
The tribe, part of their well-being, it's part of their heritage. And so, you know, it's good to see that the government does take that into consideration.
Noel says the project will install screens to help fish swim downstream into the lake. A large underwater ramp will also be built so fish can swim up and over the dam. But dams aren't the only obstacle fish populations face. The other is climate change. Last summer, unusually warm waters in the Sacramento River killed an estimated 75% of the 31 million eggs laid by Chinook salmon. In each of the previous five summers, less than 10% of the eggs died. Dan Isaac is a research fisheries scientist with the U.S. Forest Service. He says the warming waters are forcing fish to adapt.
because the peak summer temperatures in river reservoirs are getting to be so warm now that they can be lethal. We're seeing the fish kind of evolve to migrate earlier and avoid those peak temperatures, or migrate later in the fall when it starts to cool down again.
Isaac says that fish species are resilient, but with climate change continuing to dry up the West, he says individual populations are being threatened as the number of habitats shrink. Back in northern Nevada, the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe's goal is to finish the permitting process for its Fish Passage project by next year. Again, here's Donna Noel.
We have looked at many ways of solving the problem, so we're really excited.
She says construction would likely start in the fall of 2023 and take at least 8 months to complete. For Here and Now, I'm Caleb Bradle.
Okay, spare a thought for the beleaguered, misunderstood wasp. No kidding. They do pack a nasty sting. They buzz in my garden. They land in your fancy drink. They're a nasty acronym. But hold on. One researcher says open up your mind to the underappreciated contributions of the lowly wasp. Professor Siren Sumner is an entomologist and behavioral ecologist, and her book is Endless Forms, The Secret World of Wasps. Professor, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so let's first talk about this unfortunate first impression that wasps make. Why do we all love bees for their contributions to the ecology, but not wasps?
Well, I think you've already answered the question there, actually. Bees and wasps both sting, but we somehow tolerate the fact that bees sting so much better than we do wasp stings. And I think that's because we understand what bees do. The public really have a good understanding of the fact that bees are really important pollinators, and that a world without bees would all be very hungry, and there wouldn't be many flowers. Whereas wasps, we have not such a great understanding of what wasps do, at least not in the public domain.
So let's talk about the wasp ecological resume here. You talked about them eating. Well, I read they eat spiders, they eat cockroaches, they eat flies. So help us think about what would a world be without this disposal service they provide?
Yeah, I like your terminology there, disposal service. They're kind of like the caretakers, aren't they? They sort of, you know, mop up the mess that's around you. Well, okay, so let's just have a think about what else you find irritating. What other kind of creepy crawlies do you find irritating?
It's the cockroach.
The cockroach, right? That's a really good place to start. Cockroaches are hideous, right? Yeah. Maybe you hate cockroaches as much as you might hate wasps. But imagine a world without wasps would mean that there would be fewer predators of cockroaches. So what else is going to eat cockroaches? Well, there's birds, you know, other animals will eat them. But wasps do an important role in controlling those kind of pests. And then, you know, think about your back garden or your allotment. You might grow some vegetables and some salads there. What eats those vegetables and salads? Well, caterpillars, aphids, and those are exactly the kind of insects that wasps love to eat. So a world without wasps would mean, I mean, it's been described as rather flippantly as a world without wasps would be, there would almost certainly be plagues of flies, and we might be knee deep in aphids.
Can I ask you about pollination? What kinds of flowers do wasps pollinate?
Most wasps are generalist pollinators. So they tend to visit more sort of any old flower that's available. And because they're so unfussy, scientists think that possibly wasps are really important as backup pollinators, especially in degraded habitats that aren't good enough for bee populations to be sustained.
Wow. Boy, so much more to talk about. But finally, I mean, let's face it, we're not going to undo society's anti-wasp bias. I guess that would be a conscious bias or our fear of wasps. So how can we try to learn to live with them when these wasps fly into our drinks, our beers, our yards?
My first top tip to everyone is to just, when the wasp arrives at your picnic, no matter what time of year, just sit still and watch it and see what it does. And if it's early in the summer, it will be going for meat like your sausage or your pork chop or your chicken sandwich. If it's later in the summer, it'll be going for something a bit more sugary like your beer or your jam or your ice cream. And the reason for that is that early in the summer, the colonies are just starting to grow and they need to grow really fast. And the wasps that visit you at your picnics are the worker wasps, which are the hunters. And your picnic is like a, you know, it's like Christmas. It's all come at once. So early in the season, they're just looking for protein. But then later in the season, when the colony is probably at maximum capacity and most of the larvae have pupated, pupae don't need feeding. And so suddenly you've got thousands of workers which are effectively out of work. They're kind of like furloughed and they've got no hunting to do. So they have to get sugar from somewhere else. Now, normally they'll go and visit flowers, but more recently, humans have created these amazing sugar supermarkets for them, are picnics. And so that normally is what happens later on in the season. So they are simply, if you get that in your head that, okay, early season meat, late season sugar, and then when the wasp arrives at your picnic, check out what she wants and then give her a little bit of it. Give her a little... You know, give her a corner of your sausage and make it a wasp offering. Watch what she's doing and understand their life cycle and be able to live well with wasps.
Sarah Ann Sumner is an entomologist and behavioral ecologist, and her book is Endless Forms, The Secret World of Wasps. Sarah Ann, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Boston.
I'm Celeste Headley in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.